It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both?
Good.
Pretty good.
All right. You're not just making that up?
No.
No.
Okay. Absolutely true.
All right.
It's winter. I enjoy winter.
Yeah, it's winter. All right. Somewhere in the world, not here.
It's spring.
Summer.
No, it's not summer.
So, maybe in Job's little world. Well, we got...
Spring, it rains. It's not raining.
Not here anymore. They're supposed to announce a drought in a few
days.
Everything's exactly in bloom, though.
And there's no snowpack, so that drought's going to stay with us all summer, too.
That's right. So, get ready. All right, well, we got plenty to cover, starting with a local. Start with I'd wanted to cover this last week. The Sonics had gone to the legislature wanting $200 million plus for a new key arena.
And this is something that should happen more often to sports franchises. They got laughed at. I thought it was really, really kind of a tremendous advance for Western civilization as we know it.
And it wasn't just the Sonics that went to legislature. It was our mayor, Nichols, who went with them.
And he got laughed at, too, which is even better.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is this week, too, one of the reasons the Sonics went to the legislature is because Mayor Nichols had this great plan to sell the land that has their practice court on it to the Gates Foundation. Well, this week, the city council voted to go ahead with that sale, to sell that land to the Gates Foundation to redevelop and use for other purposes. And that leaves the Sonics kind of out in the cold as far as where they're going to practice, unless they want to use a space that should be rented out more often, and that's the Key Arena. So it'll be interesting to see what happens now.
Yeah, and there's some question about it, the price that they sold that to them for, if that was really the going market rate.
The Gates Foundation, yeah, because they hadn't done an independent appraisal of the land before they did the sale. Now, I read Nick Licata's reasons for voting for it, and it seemed pretty reasonable. He said that the city had kind of been holding on to that parcel of land in the hopes that a buyer would turn up, and no buyer has turned up. And that the Gates Foundation came along looking for a parcel of land in the neighborhood, and they went ahead negotiating with them. Now, I don't know. I haven't looked at the actual figures for why a parcel that, if it didn't have, if it could be easily developed, would go for something around $70 million, went for $22. That seems to me to be a considerable break in the price, and I haven't looked at why the price was brought down, but there are various factors involved, like putting in roads to divide the parcel, you know, taking down some buildings, putting up other buildings, building a parking garage, etc. And of course, the words parking garage always brings up, kind of brings my hackles up because of the really bad parking garage deal that the city entered into with Nordstrom a while back for that downtown parking garage, which I think was still a really bad deal. So, I mean, I'd have to look at the details, and it's hard to know what the details are yet.
Well, I thought it was actually around, like, $50 million, and then, like, 30 of that or 20-something of that was getting off loaded to other parts of Seattle Center.
Exactly.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, and I've heard a potential value for the parcel of $70 million. So, I mean, it's hard to know in this real estate market unless you have an appraiser or two appraisers come in and look at it to really know what the value would be.
All right. Well, and
the city didn't do that.
So supposedly they're getting back to the Sonics deal. Supposedly they're going back to the legislature with a revised plan.
A much lower plan this time, under $100 million, I believe.
Under $100 million still for, you know, the arena. It was just done 10 years ago.
Yeah, but this is just to revamp the arena. It's not to do the whole new arena as they were talking about before.
Right.
Yeah, no, they were going to add more luxury boxes, which is absurd considering that in other venues, the luxury boxes are the things that have been the hardest to sell. They wanted to add a new practice arena, space right next to the Key Arena and new offices and, you know, basically perks that would benefit mostly the team rather than the fans. And I don't see how that's going to bring in more people to Key Arena, which should be the goal, given that the Seattle Center is running at a deficit and needs more people to come and attend events at Key Arena.
So we also always seem to find plenty of money in this town for stadiums and, you know, sports facilities. But the Hygiene Center has been working on trying to find a home for a long time.
Yeah, this is something that's been going on for nearly a decade now, dating back to the old proposals to put one in the Glen Hotel downtown in the mid-90s. But finally this week, City Council voting 6-1 with Jan Drago being the only nay vote, voted in favor of putting a hygiene center in Morrison Hotel, where there are already a lot of other services for the homeless. This is at 3rd and James, I believe it is?
I think so.
Right about there. Now, this is not Greg Nichols' proposal. He had a separate proposal to put it in along with a fire station at 4th and Yesler, which was a more expensive proposal. But he went along with the vote for the Morrison Hotel proposal that Tom Rasmussen put forward. So this is a done deal. This is going to happen, and it will open up sometime next year. It's a good day for the... Or actually, I suppose they've still got to find somewhere to shower sometime in the next year. But after that, it'll be a good day for the city's homeless.
Yeah, it's a good day for the city, I think, too. The fact that the mayor actually put the money forward for it, and that the city council, in a tough economic time. Yeah, and the city council moved forward on it and came to an agreement, and that activists have fought for this for over a decade and finally gotten something. It's a good day for the whole city.
Yep.
Well, speaking of activists, Jackie Hudson is coming home here soon.
Yeah, this is a Mary Knoll nun who has been in jail for the last 2.5 years, dating back to a plowshares action that she and two other nuns from Baltimore took in the summer of 2001, I believe it was, in Colorado, against a nuclear missile silo there. They hammered on it and beat their swords into plowshares, and the federal judge in the case didn't particularly like that action, and so they sentenced him to 2.5 years in prison. She is coming home. She was released from prison yesterday in Southern California, and I think it was Victorville, and will be home in Ground Zero in Kitsap County tomorrow. I believe she'll be having a welcome home bash. But there is still a complication in the case, because she is refusing to pay restitution in the case. The government is claiming that the various nuns, and these are all elderly women. Jackie is 70 years old, and she's been a mainstay in local anti-disarmament activism for the last decade or so. But the other women were also in their early 60s, I believe, early and mid-60s. So they aren't exactly menace to society, you know, type material here, but they were ordered to pay restitution, quite a hefty fee, as I believe. I think it was close to $1 million, something outrageous like that.
I didn't hear that was quite that high.
I'll check on that and get back to you, because I have it here in my notes somewhere.
Hopefully that'll happen in the next half hour. I've seen your notes.
Exactly. But in any event, they're refusing to pay restitution. And so as a result, it may be that for the probationary period of the sentence, she will be forced to spend that in Colorado rather than in her home in Kitsap County. So this is something in Bremerton. So this is something that a judge is going to rule on probably in the next week or so in Colorado. So we will wish her well in that ruling as well.
Yeah, be keeping our eyes
on
that.
And welcome home to Jackie. It's been a long time coming. And thank you for your courageous work.
Very good. All right, and then sticking with the state, we were all looking at apparently higher electric rates here in the short term, and that actually got nixed.
Yes, it did. According to Patty Murray and various other Republican legislators from Idaho and Oregon, the budget proposal for the Bush administration for the fiscal year 2006, had in it a provision that the Bonneville Power Administration sell its power at market rates. Now, it's much cheaper rates than that to the four-state area in the Pacific Northwest right now.
They sell it at cost.
They sell it at cost, basically, which is way less than most of the rest of the country is paying. And the idea of the Bush administration was to raise some money for the general fund and the federal budget by selling it at market rates instead, which effectively would have been a huge tax increase for the four-state area. In the Pacific Northwest, and this was something that legislators on both sides of the aisle in all four states were adamantly opposed to, and it's apparently dead in the water. So that was one bad proposal in the Bush administration's budget that will not be coming to fruition.
All right, we'll jump into national. The The Senate is proposing some changes to bankruptcy laws. Is that going to be good for us?
No. Well, it depends, actually. If you make more than about $500,000 a year, it will be very good for you, actually. But the way it's being structured, this is a bill that's going through the Senate right now and is expected to follow suit in the House fairly soon. Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which is different from Chapter 13 in that you don't have to have a repayment plan attached to the bankruptcy, is basically going to be eliminated for people who can't afford fairly wealthy tax dodges that are currently available in about 5 states, but available to anybody who lives anywhere around the country as a way to hide your assets. But if you don't have that ability to hide your assets, you will have to pay back these bankruptcies. And about half of the bankruptcies charged are due to catastrophic medical problems. So this is something where it's not necessarily deadbeats or people who went shopping too much at the bond. It's people who have had really serious problems come up in their lives.
People who are keeping track of their finances, they're doing fine, they don't have a lot of debt. But then a spouse gets severely ill, cancer or emphysema or heart disease, something where they need a lot of medical treatment. Insurance covers only so much, and then they got to start paying out of pocket, and they run into debt pretty quickly. And after a while, that debt mounts and mounts and mounts, and suddenly they're in bankruptcy. And if you don't have a type of bankruptcy that allows people in that situation, who got into that situation through no fault of their own, to get out of it, then you really have to ask, what's next? Debtor's prison for these people? I mean, I don't understand why they would eliminate Chapter 7 bankruptcy. It makes no sense. Unless, of course, you are a Republican fat cat sitting in the Senate, and your constituents are these big credit card companies and big banks that want to eliminate Chapter 7 bankruptcy because they always want to squeeze something out of the people whose loans they've bought. They always want to get something back on their investment. That's really the only people who would benefit from this.
Yeah, and by the way, it was $3,000 for Jackie Hudson. It wasn't a million. I was looking at a separate figure, which was
some difference, Josh.
Well, it was her supporters have actually offered to pay an alternative restitution, which was several hundred thousands worth of dollars. That's the figure that I was thinking of, but that's been rejected. They want the money from her. But in any event, back to the bankruptcy. One of the other interesting things about this is a piece of legislation that credit card companies and banks have been pushing really hard for, and there were a series of amendments that Democrats offered to this bill on Thursday that were all rejected by the Republican majority, and some of them were very common sense provisions. There was one in there to. Again, to allow for some means testing for repayment schedules, and to allow for some waiver of that. There was one had a cap of 30% on what credit card companies could charge their customers, which, you know, I don't know why credit card companies would need to charge more than 30%, but there you have it. It's a free country.
I don't know why they would need to charge, you know, 20% to 30%,
yeah,
or 10% to 20%.
But one of the interesting things about this is that MBNA, which is a very large credit card company, the Maryland Bank of North America, was George Bush's single largest contributor during the 2004 presidential campaign. So a lot of this is payback.
Yeah.
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching.
Well, and as I think Maria, as you pointed out on previous shows, a lot of these credit card companies aren't. You know, they say such and such, you know, bank of wherever. I mean, they're not even real banks.
No. I mean, you can hold the credit card from the bank of wherever, and it's really not a bank. It's just, you know, a credit card company. There's no bank there. And there are a lot of companies as well who are never used to be in any kind of financial related business who are now offering credit cards and credit lines. And that's a whole story in itself, the vast expansion of credit to people who never used to qualify. Folks who wouldn't make enough money to qualify for a credit card can now get credit on just about anything, including things that were to buy things that they probably shouldn't be buying, you know. And so it's much, much easier for people to get into trouble than it used to be in the past.
All right. Well, let's move along. I met funding. and Indonesia?
Yeah, IMET is International Military Education and Training, and it's kind of a slush fund that the military uses to direct training and weaponry and things like that to various militaries around the world. And the Bush administration, rather, has lifted its ban on IMET training money to the Indonesian military. Now, this is something that's attached to a congressional ban on weapon sales to the Indonesian military that goes back over a decade to the massacre of a number of civilians in East Timor in 1991. And this is something that actually predates the tsunami. The Bush administration had been pushing for some time for a lift of this to the Indonesian military. But the problem with this is that many of the people who have been responsible for atrocities in East Timor, atrocities in Aceh province, they're still in positions of authority. None of these people have ever been held accountable for their fairly grievous genocidal level crimes.
And they're high ranking members of the Indonesian military.
Yeah, they're very, very high ranking members. And so this is something where, these are the kind of people the Pentagon would like to do business with. And so we're slowly but surely seeing a slide down that slippery slope back to full funding for the Indonesian military from the U.S. government, which is definitely not the kind of friends we want to be hanging out with.
And is that something that Congress or Senate is going to have a chance to have a say in, or have they pretty much already rubber stamped it?
Well, at this point, you've got Republicans in the House that dominate the House and the Senate. So anything that comes from the Bush administration, foreign policy-wise, is going to get a hearing and probably going to get a lot of support from Congress.
Yeah, this was a decision by Condoleezza Rice, and so it doesn't go through Congress per se, but you could definitely have somebody like, say, the Senate Democrats from the state of Washington lean a little bit on the Bush administration to reconsider that, and also to make sure that the congressional ban on military funding for the Indonesian military is not lifted.
All right.
Especially when the Bush administration keeps saying it supports democracy abroad, they should be pointing out that if you support democracy abroad, why are you giving direct support to these guys who don't believe in democracy?
Yeah. And there was also, incidentally, a massacre this past week in Colombia, also by a paramilitary group there. So just as a reminder that we're also cozying up to the wrong people in that part of the world.
All right, South Carolina. There's a judge in South Carolina that had something to say this week about...
In the Jose Padilla case, folks might not remember who Jose Padilla is. He was supposed to be, the 20th hijacker who didn't make it on...
22nd
hijacker. Well, the Bush administration arrested him when he was trying to return to the United States from a trip abroad. I believe he was coming home from Pakistan.
Yes.
And they claimed that he was going to try to plant a dirty bomb in an American city because they had found some evidence that he had actually looked at some websites on the internet that have to do with how to make a dirty bomber or how to get your hands on radioactive isotopes or something like that. Some very kind of iffy evidence. But he's been held in federal prison for 2.5 years. And the U.S. government...
With no charges.
Yeah, and the U.S. government has not brought any charges against him. And his lawyers have had to take this to court since then. Now, there was a federal judge that ruled a while back that he should be released or that the government should either bring charges or they should release him, that it's unconstitutional for the government to hold an American citizen in prison without bringing any charges or holding a trial.
Yeah, and this is the whole rationale of holding somebody as an enemy combatant.
Right, and then the Bush administration appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at the Padilla case and they threw it back and said Padilla's lawyers needed to file the case in a different court. They needed to go to the federal court in the state where he was being held, in South Carolina. So they went to South Carolina, and their case appeared before a judge that was appointed by George Bush in 2003, considered a very conservative federal judge. He looked at the case, and he laughed, and he said, the Bush administration needs to release this guy or bring charges against him. Exactly the same ruling that Padilla's lawyers won in the earlier trial. So clearly, this is further evidence that the Bush administration cannot trample on the Constitution, declare American citizens enemy combatants, and hold them indefinitely. Although they're trying to do that, the Bush administration is going to appeal this case as long as they can and try to keep him in prison for as long as they can. But
yeah, they can do it. It's just not legal.
They're going to exhaust their options eventually.
Yeah, I can tell you, if you want to get your hands on radioactive isotopes, just go to the Columbia River and dip them in.
Start,
you know, just south of Hanford.
Yeah, start digging up a little soil there.
Yeah, you don't need to
need to do that. You just cut down some of the sagebrush.
You know, grab a salmon popping out of there. All right. So the ACLU this week is taking action with Mr. Rumsfeld.
Yes, the ACLU is assisting 8 different, mostly Afghans, also Iraqis, who suffered torture at the hands of U.S. forces in those countries in the past 3 years. And they have filed suit in, I believe, Chicago against Donald Rumsfeld, saying that this is the man who is responsible for the torture of these individuals. This is where the policy started, the very top.
And that he knew about it as it was happening.
Yeah,
he did nothing.
He knew about it as it was happening. It was a clear policy that emanated from the very top of the Bush administration. And assuming that this has an opportunity to go to trial, it could be a very interesting case. I would love to be a fly on the wall for some of the depositions in this case.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not. Love to be a fly on the wall because
yeah,
I'm sure some,
be
of
very
her, some of the
careful.
Testimony would not be very pleasant, but you know,
careful
it would be interesting.
What you wish for.
Yeah, that's yeah. true.
All right, well, then that takes us to this week in Iraq.
The big news story this week in Iraq is that it is now more than a month since the January 30th elections, and the new interim government has yet to meet or even to form. There have been a lot of negotiations going on to form the new government, but they have so far stalled. Now, just to review with people, 2/3 of the folks who were elected on January 30th have to get together and select a prime minister and members for the cabinet, for the new cabinet, and then vote on those before the parliament can actually convene. It's kind of a backwards process, if you ask me. Now, the leading party in the elections, the United Iraqi Alliance, they did not get a 2/3 majority outright as they had hoped. They got about a 50% majority. The next largest group was the Kurdish List, which won about 27%. Now, if those two groups can get together and agree on a prime minister and some cabinet posts, then they'd be in business. However, the Kurds are playing hardball. I'm just going to go over really quickly what each group wants. First of all, what the Shiites want for a new government is they would like an Islamic government. Now, there are some commentators say, no, that's not true, but the leading members of the United Iraqi Alliance have said that they do want an Islamic government. They would some of the members of the group would like Islamic law. They would like, is certainly, at the very least, would like Islam as the national religion, which could be a problem because not everybody living in Iraq is a Muslim. They would also like to vastly rewrite the Constitution to have it conform to Islamic law. And in particular, they would like to remove the three-province clause. The three-province clause, very briefly, it says that any three provinces can vote. If any three provinces vote against the Constitution, the new Constitution, it will not go into force, which gives the Kurdish North a veto power over the new Constitution. It might also give the Sunnis, who you could arguably say control about three provinces in Iraq, a veto over the new Constitution. So because the Constitution will be drafted by the new assembly and then it will go to a popular vote of the country, that is a problem in the eyes of the Shiites. They would like to remove that three-province clause. They want to keep the city of Kirkuk within central Iraq.
As opposed to the Kurds
who would like to declare it part of Kurdish territory. And the Shiites want to continue the de-bathification process, which was begun by the Coalition Provisional Authority, which means banning anybody who had been a member of the Ba'ath Party from serving in high government office in the new government. Now, on the other hand, the Kurds want, first of all, to expand their autonomy. They want to keep their Peshmerga militia. They want to keep their taxing authority over the three Kurdish provinces. In other words, to collect taxes and have it go to their own autonomous regional government. They want to incorporate the city of Kirkuk, which sits on top of some pretty big oil reserves. They want to incorporate that into the Kurdish autonomous region. They want to keep the current constitutional draft and have that be the basis of the new constitution, and they definitely want to keep the three-province clause. And finally, they want to have a Kurdish leader be the next president. Currently, it's mostly a ceremonial post, but currently the presidency is held by a Sunni. That's kind of an interesting thing. We'll talk about a little bit more here. Now, the Shiites are willing to grant a Kurdish presidency, but they've balked at all the other Kurdish demands. And that's one of the reasons why there's been some stalling. Now, there have also been efforts to bring the Sunnis into the new government. Some of the Shiite members of the Shiite United Iraqi Alliance have met with Sunnis, not just the Sunni members of the United Iraqi Alliance, because there are a few, and some Sunni members of Ayat Alawi's party, and there are a few there as well, but a few other Sunnis who did not participate in the elections but are considered representatives of the Sunni community have met with the Shiites, and the Sunni demands are this. They want to keep the presidency. We'll see. They want a timeline for U.S. troop withdrawal. They want a curtailment of U.S. troop offensives in Sunni regions of Iraq because it has brought high civilian casualties and destroyed a lot of the infrastructure in Sunni parts of Iraq, in particular the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi. And they want an end to the extensive de-Ba'athification program, which is being heavily pushed by the returning exiles who dominate the United Iraqi Alliance, the Shiite group. As you can see, there's not much agreement between the three groups. And it is turning out to be a bit of chaos. The analysts who are looking at this, they think the negotiations could drag on for several more weeks. I think it could go on for months, personally. The Constitution is supposed to be drafted. The new Constitution is supposed to be drafted by August and then go to a popular vote by December. And the law says that there can be a six-month extension to those due dates. I think they might need more than that, more time than that. We'll see if the new government actually ever really gets off the ground.
Yeah, but freedom is on the march, right?
That's what the Bush administration says. In the meantime, there's a caretaker government. Ayat Alawi's government stays in power doing kind of minimal things to keep the country supposedly running, if you could call the current state of Iraq as a country that's running. Many Iraqis say that that's not true. And as an illustration of this, one of the other big stories in Iraq this week was the shooting of the Italian reporter Giuliana Sgrena, who had been held hostage by a Sunni Muslim or Islamic group. It's not clear which was holding her hostage. Her release was negotiated by some Italian intelligence officers. They were driving her back to Baghdad. It was late at night. It was about 9 p.m. at night when they encountered a surprise U.S. checkpoint. All they saw were lights flashing at them out of the dark, shots fired into the air, and then they were shot at. One of the Italian intelligence officers, the man who had negotiated her release, was killed, and she was wounded. This has created an international incident with one of our leading allies in Europe. The Italian prime minister wants an explanation for this. It really highlights what the Iraqi people have been protesting about over the U.S. government occupation. One of the big things that they don't like is the fact that the U.S. throws up these roadblocks and shoots people in the middle of the night if they don't slow down. Now, from the Iraqi perspective, you never slow down at night when you're driving. And you see lights flashing at you and you hear gunshots, you assume it is a criminal gang attacking, because there are many in Iraq right now, and you speed up. And this time around, it was a foreign government's personnel who were shot, and that, you know, one of our allies, and that might mean that something actually gets done about this problem.
Yeah, as opposed to just being another Iraqi, in which case, you know, life is cheap, right?
Right.
Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again to John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free publications around town. We can also be found on the web. Our web address is www.eatthestate.org.